As we look at this book of Joshua this morning, I've done one thing that those of you who know anything about me will have thought could never have happened. I've come and forgotten to bring my map with me. Now, there's one thing that I always feel we should have with us is a map when we're looking at the scriptures. Now, it just so happens that the section that I'm looking at this morning won't be too badly affected by the absence of a map, and I'll make sure I rectify the situation before we meet back here again tonight. Can I just ask you to imagine that you're looking at a map of Palestine. On the left-hand side, as you look at it, you have the Mediterranean Sea, and then you have the coastline of Palestine coming down more or less north-south, a bit obliquely, like that. And then coming down also inland, you have the Jordan River, north-south. Now, the area between the Jordan River and the Palestine coast is the land of Canaan. Now, that's the area that was promised to the people of Israel. What has happened is this. They have come from Egypt. You know the story of Moses and the people in Egypt, and then the plagues of Egypt and all the terrible happenings there, the Passover, and then the escape from Egypt, the miraculous passage through the Red Sea, and then the journey through the various different parts of the country until they came to Mount Sinai. And there at Mount Sinai, they got the law given to them through Moses. And now they've moved on from Sinai, and they've come round by a circuitous route, and they're going to take the land of Canaan from the east. That is, the moving, as you look at your imaginary map, the moving from right to left. They're going to cross the River Jordan and then conquer the land of Canaan. Moses, in the meantime, has died, and the leader of the nation is Joshua, the man from whom this book takes its name. Firstly, a few notes concerning Joshua. He was a man that had already established himself as a very competent leader in Israel. If you send your mind back to some of the stories you may have read or heard earlier, you'll find out that there was an occasion when the Israelites were attacked by a band of raiding desert nomads way back in the time before they reached Mount Sinai. And the man that was chosen to organize the first Israelite fighting force was this man Joshua. So he proved to be a very competent military commander. You find then that he was appointed as Moses' chief assistant. And in various stories you meet in the books that have preceded Joshua, you find that he had considerable administrative ability, this man Joshua. You also find that he was a man of some spiritual perception. So he was a good army leader, he was a good administrator, and he was also a good spiritual guide. And the best story there to illustrate the point is the one of the 12 spies who went to spy out the land, and 10 of them said, we couldn't take this land, they wouldn't believe God, and the people followed those 10. But there were 2 spies who said, we can trust in God, we can take this land, and Joshua was one of those. So he proved also to be a man of faith, a man who knew God. Now this is the man that God appointed to be Moses' successor. And now Joshua is going to lead the people to cross the Jordan River and take the land. So the book of Joshua, you could summarize by saying that it is the book of the conquest and division of the land of Canaan. I'm going to look at it in 4 studies. Now, I'm sure you'll appreciate that in 4 half-hour studies over 24 chapters, we aren't going to be able to do the book in any great detail. But I trust that you have got time somewhere this week to read the book right through so that you can get yourself into the mood and find out what's really happening here. What I want to do today is look at the first 5 chapters, that's this morning, the first 5 chapters, which concern preparations for the entrance into Canaan. And then tonight, chapters 6 to 12, which is the actual conquest of Canaan. Next Sunday morning, chapters 13 to 22, which concerns the division of the land among the 12 tribes of Israel. And then in the final study, the last 2 chapters of the book, which concern Joshua's farewell to the people. So we come now to the opening chapter of Joshua. Now Joshua's commission from God was very brief and straightforward. He had to take the land of Canaan. And the first chapter of Joshua, particularly the first 9 verses, are very well known to us. Great words of encouragement which God spoke to Joshua, and which I'm sure many of us have read at times and taken great encouragement from them ourselves. And there is a real need in our Christian lives for this ministry of encouragement. We'll read these verses through because it sets the tone of the book. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' minister, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan. Get the picture here. Go over this Jordan. They are camped on the eastern side of the Jordan, and now they have to go over it to conquer the land which was on the west of Jordan, between the Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea. Go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land which I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I will give to you, as I promised to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and the Hittites here seem to be, or the name Hittites is used as a general name for the inhabitants of Canaan. You'll find that more frequently they're referred to as Amorites. Well, in the context that we're speaking of here, if it speaks of the Hittites or the Canaanites or the Amorites, more or less it's speaking of the same people. The land of the Hittites to the Great Sea. The Great Sea, of course, is the Mediterranean on the western coast, towards the going down of the sun. That shall be your territory. Verse 5, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. So be strong and of good courage, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only, and here is the proviso, you might say. Great promises, these promises we have from God here. And of course we all like to read the promises and take heart from them. But read the next few words. Be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. So he's got to be obedient if he really wants to enjoy the benefits of those promises. Let us bear that in mind at all times. We have no right to take some of these promises and apply them to ourselves unless we also are prepared to be obedient to the word of God. Now in this case, it was the word which God had given to Israel through Moses, the law. I guess we can apply it to ourselves and take it to apply to the whole of God's word. Some people look upon the Bible as a sort of optional extra to the Christian life. As long as you're doing bright things and serving the Lord in various ways and going to certain religious functions, then that is the main thing. And the Bible takes very much a back place in their list of priorities. As you read on, you find here that this book in verse 8, this book of the law, shall not depart out of your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. So there must be an understanding of the word of God as he had given it to the people, and a willingness to put that word into practice. So if you want the promises of God, take the conditions that go with them. And the conditions in this case are, apply yourself to knowing God's word and then do it. And if you do that, then you are entitled to claim the promises. Be careful to do according to all that is written in it, and then you shall make your way prosperous, and then you shall have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Be not frightened, neither be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. And as you come to the second half of the chapter, we are told about 2.5 tribes, 2.5 of the 12 tribes, who had decided that they wanted to settle east of Jordan. They had good flocks of cattle, herds of cattle, flocks of sheep, and they saw that these were good pasture lands, and they asked permission that they might settle there. They didn't want to go across Jordan into the main body of Canaan itself. And Moses struck a deal with them, and he said, okay, you can have your inheritance here on this side of the Jordan, provided your fighting men go across with the remainder of the fighting men of Israel and help to conquer Canaan. And after you've won the conquest, then the men of those 2.5 tribes can go back and settle with your wife and family in your flocks and your herds east of Jordan. And as you read through the remainder of chapter 1, you find that these 2.5 tribes were as good as their word. They said, yes, we will keep our promise and we will go over and fight. A good lesson for us there. An honourable thing for God's people to do what they say they are going to do. And there are lots of people that don't take that very seriously, I'm afraid. They say they're going to do something, and when the crunch comes, they have all sorts of excuses for not doing it. Well, that simply is not on as far as the obedience of God's people is concerned. So the 2.5 tribes say, yes, we'll go and help fight, and then we'll return and settle here. We come to chapter 2, and we find that the first city that they had to take was Jericho, because Jericho blocked their path through the mountain pass into the regions beyond. So although they had the promise of God's blessing and protection and direction, they still wanted to search out so that they could know what they were up against. A good combination here of trust in God, but at the same time being sensible and finding out all the facts. Christians tend to go off to an extreme on one side or the other. Some people talk all about the leading of the Lord and never take the time to inform themselves of the facts. And then there's the other temptations to inform yourself of the facts and forget about that dependency upon God. Here you find that the two were tied together, and so Joshua sent these couple of spies to find out what they could about Jericho. And he found out that the people were terrified, that they had heard about the Israelites, and they were quaking in their boots as they knew that the Israelites were about to attack them. Now these couple of spies, in keeping with the one-track mind that soldiers so often have, found their way into the home of a prostitute. And it just so happened that this woman made some sort of response when she met them, because she too had heard about the God of the Israelites. And as you read on, you find that she became some sort of a believer in Jehovah. In verse 9, she said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no courage left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God is he who is God in heaven above and on earth beneath." When you come to the book of Hebrews, you find that Rahab, this woman, is commended for her faith. She had heard sufficient, and she knew sufficient of the God of Israel to trust in his power and in his mercy to save her. I trust also she had a change of occupation. We're not told much more about her, except that the men said that if she was to be preserved, she too had to be obedient to certain requirements they laid down for her. There's a point here, I think, that we should remind ourselves of constantly, and that is that God's salvation always depends upon faith. That's what God's looking for, faith. Now, faith will develop and grow, and it must always be linked with obedience. But God never asks us to have a great knowledge of him before he accepts us. He doesn't ask us to have come a long way in moral reform before he accepts us. He accepts us when we turn to him in faith. And all the people that have ever been justified from the beginning of time right through till now have been justified solely on the basis of faith. That's why God accepts them. And so this woman is commended because she had faith. But there's an interesting connection that the Bible always makes between faith and obedience. Now, we're not saved on the basis of our works, but yet if we don't have works, well, then we have no grounds for saying that our faith is saving faith. And what the Bible warns us against by precept and example time and again is having some sort of faith which is so many words. We think we're saved because we know things. We are told repeatedly, and the sayings of our Lord Jesus Christ himself are the ones that are the most disturbing when it comes to this point, that faith that does not demonstrate itself in changed lives and in obedience to God is not saving faith. And the person who thinks that faith is saving faith is only deceiving himself if he is not being obedient to God. You find as these men moved on, they gave this woman some ways of demonstrating her faith. She was to protect the people when they came through, and she was to keep the matter a secret, and if she gave a certain sign, then when the Israelites invaded, they would not destroy her house and those inside. And so she guaranteed her own safety as she demonstrated her faith by her obedience. That more or less takes up the remainder of the chapter, which brings us then to chapter 3. This was to be no ordinary battle. It was not just a case of territorial expansion. This was the fulfillment of the covenant promises which God had given Abraham and the forefathers of the nation. And so you find there is a great linking up of religious ideas with this conquest. The first few verses of chapter 3. Early in the morning, Joshua rose and set out for Shittim with all the people of Israel. And they came to the Jordan and lodged there before they passed over. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, "When you see the Ark of the Covenant..." The Ark of the Covenant was the symbol of God's presence. It normally dwelt inside the tabernacle, which was the tent or the temporary sanctuary that they took with them on their travels. He says, "When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it, that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. Yet there shall be a space between you and it, a distance of about 2,000 cubits, which is about a kilometer. Do not come near it." And Joshua said to the people, "Sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you." God is going to lead them symbolically in the form of this Ark of the Covenant, which will lead the way towards the Jordan and then across and into the land. But there's this kilometer between them, just to keep the people aware that they are to treat God with reverence and respect. There's a general encouragement towards awe, reverence for God in the whole of this operation. And here again are two apparently contradictory truths we must always hold in balance. One, the intimacy which we have with God, He is our Father. The other, the respect and the awe with which we come before Him, because He is also our Creator. He is the Lord, He is the Sovereign, He is the King. So we hold the two in balance. And this was no ordinary battle. So you find the religious significance of the Ark, the priests, the sanctifying of themselves, the ritual cleansing of themselves. The whole thing is a religious operation as well as a military operation. And then we come to the story of the division of the Jordan River. This again was a miracle done by God, but like many of the other miracles you meet, it may have had an origin which is to be explained fairly simply in terms of the terrain of the country. One of the things that is known is that occasionally the Jordan River is affected by some sort of earthquake activity in the area, and its banks tend to fall in. And this has happened several times when the banks of the Jordan have fallen in and dam up the river. Now in this case you find that what happens is that the banks of the Jordan caved in upriver around about 25 kilometres at a place called Adam, and it dammed up the stream. So that by the time the Israelites got to the crossing point, they were able to cross over without any trouble. And they all just got across. By the time they got across, the dam up there had broken because of the build-up of water behind it, and came rushing through and back to flood level again. Now the miracle of it all is, of course, in the fact that it happened at precisely the moment God decreed and declared it would happen. So that's the miracle of it. The fact that it may have some sort of explanation doesn't in any way diminish the miraculous element that God was demonstrating, that He was doing this and He was the one who was leading the people into the land He had promised them. In verse 15 of chapter 3, "When those who bore the ark, that is the priests, had come to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the ark were dipped in the brink of the water," the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of harvest, "the waters coming down from above stood and rose up in a heap far off at Adam," the city that is beside Zarethan. So this place of Adam, which you can locate as being approximately 25 kilometres upstream, that's where the water was dammed up, as it says in verse 16. But of course it had happened some hours previous to the arrival of the people there, so that by the time they got there, the water level had been reduced, and those in verse 17, the people of Israel were able to pass over on dry land. "The priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all the nation passed over." You find then that as they passed over, to mark this great event, Joshua told the people to take 12 stones out of the bed of the river, representing the 12 tribes of Israel, and to set them up in the place where they camped that night. And the place where they camped that night was going to be a place which is known as Gilgal. In verse 3 of chapter 4, we find Joshua commanding the people to take 12 stones from out of the midst of the Jordan, from the very place where the priest's feet stood, and carry them over with you, and lay them down in the place where you shall lodge tonight. It seems to me there was another memorial of 12 stones set up in the middle of the river itself. In verse 9, apart from those 12 stones which the people took and set up in Gilgal, Joshua, in verse 9, set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant had stood, and they are there to this day. We find then that after the people had passed over, in verse 18, "When the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came up from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up on dry ground, the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and overflowed all its banks as before. And the people in the meantime moved on and set up their camp at Gilgal. And Gilgal now became the headquarters for the military campaign which was to follow. So all the time now you're going to find the message or the story going back to Gilgal. That was the headquarters where Joshua directed affairs from, and it was where the people set up camp that night. In verse 19, they came up out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they encamped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. So you have the picture there that Gilgal is east of Jericho. So Jericho is still the town which they have first to attack before they can go any further. Well, they're in the land now, and they're getting ready to commence the conquest. However, before they can take this land which God had promised them according to the covenant he made with Abraham, they themselves must make sure that they conform to the requirements of the covenant. Now, if you send your mind back to Abraham, God promised Abraham, one, that he would have a nation of people descended from him. Now, if you've got a nation of people, they've got to live somewhere. So God said, all right, I'll give them a land to live in as well. Well, over the several hundred years since that promise was given, the nation had now come into existence, and it was there in its own right as a nation. Now the second part of the promise was to be fulfilled. The people were to take up the occupancy of the land God had promised to give them. If they were to occupy this land God gave them according to the covenant, it was only fitting that they themselves should make sure that they had conformed to the requirements of the covenant. Now, a covenant is an agreement. It's an agreement with which God made with Abraham. It wasn't an agreement which God negotiated with Abraham. God gave him the promise purely out of God's sovereign grace. Of his own free will, God promised this to Abraham. But once he had made the promise to Abraham, he said of Abraham, "Now I require this of you in response. If you are to enjoy the blessings that I promised you in this covenant agreement, then you must obey my laws, and you must carry out the sign of the covenant." And the sign of the covenant was circumcision. So all of Abraham's household, all the males in his household, were then circumcised, which was the permanent sign, the mark put in the body, which could not be removed, so that that would be a sign that they were God's covenant people. And from that time onwards, every time a baby boy was born, when it was about a week old, it was circumcised in fulfillment of this covenant. There was one problem that had arisen during the 40 years that the people had been wandering around in the wilderness, because the generation which now came into Canaan was not the same generation that existed back when Moses received the law at Mount Sinai. From Mount Sinai to the time we're talking about here is a period of, let us say, approximately 40 years. And during that time, all the older people had died off, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb. And the people during those 40 years had in many ways neglected the requirements which God laid upon them. And one of the requirements which they neglected was this requirement of circumcision. So God said, before you go into the land, you must conform to the basic requirement of the covenant, the very first requirement of the covenant, and that is the circumcision of all males. And so there was a general circumcision carried out throughout the whole of the population of males, adult right down to children. This was the second time there had been such a mass circumcision, you might say. There had been one when the covenant was first inaugurated, way back in the time of Abraham. That was the first general circumcision. And now, because of the neglectfulness of the people during the previous 40 years, there is now a second general circumcision. So we're back to square one again, and from here on, the newborn babies are circumcised as they should have been in the first place. So that's the significance then of verse 2 of chapter 5. At that time the Lord said to Joshua, "Make flint knives and circumcise the people of Israel again the second time." The first time being in the time of Abraham, the second time being here in the time of Joshua. That was done. And then in verse 10, the people of Israel were encamped at Gilgal. They kept the Passover. Again, it appears they hadn't kept the Passover during the previous 40 years, because uncircumcised people were not allowed to keep the Passover. But now that that circumcision has been done, they have kept the Passover. And in verse 11, on the morrow after the Passover, on that very day, they ate the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased on the morrow when they ate of the produce of the land, and the people of Israel had manna no more, but ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. Manna had been given to them as God's miraculous provision of food during the period of their 40 years from Egypt to Canaan. Now that they had arrived in Canaan, there was no need for that provision any further. And so the journey is now officially ended, and the manna ceases. One final word in verses 13 to 15. A mysterious character here appears. When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" He said, "No, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord bid his servant?" And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Put off your shoes from your feet, for the place where you stand is holy." And Joshua did so. This mysterious person, who is some sort of representative of the Lord, frequently in the Old Testament you find this sort of thing occurring, someone called the messenger of the Lord or the angel of the Lord, some special supernatural type of revelation given to somebody as God in the form of some person approaches this person. And immediately Joshua recognizes that this is no ordinary man. This is the director of affairs. We don't meet this character very often at all as we move through the story, but it appears that the whole of the campaign to follow, although Joshua organized it and it was carried out with much thought and precision, always it was under the overall control and direction of God. Now that is the point that I think we should leave ourselves with. In spite of all our organization, all the direction which we like to take our affairs in our lives, everything must be ultimately under the control and direction of God. And for that reason, we, like Joshua, must stand before him, take our shoes from our feet, and realize that the place where we stand before God is holy ground.